This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. When you enter the virtual space of The Briefing Room, you can expect 28 minutes of the top experts explaining one of the big issues of the moment. This week, who are the Uyghurs and what's happening to them? Not much unites American politicians, but one issue now seems to.
China is home to one of the worst human rights crises of our time. It is truly the stain of the century.
We are sending a message to the persecuted that they are not forgotten.
This is a genocide. More than a million people are in concentration camps. Millions more are harassed every single day. The whole families have been torn apart.
Those voices belong to Donald Trump's Secretary of State, to the Democrat Speaker of the House of Representatives, and to a Republican congressman. They were talking about the Chinese government's treatment of a mainly Muslim minority, the Uyghurs, in the province of Xinjiang. The US has announced sanctions against Chinese Communist Party officials it says are involved in that treatment. China denies behaving badly and has retaliated with sanctions of its own, warning the US to stop interfering in its internal affairs. So this week, I want to know who the Uyghurs are, what's really been going on, and is it as bad as people have been claiming? And how should the world respond? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. The first thing I want to know is who the Uyghurs are and what the part of China they live in, Xinjiang, is like. Ryan Thum is a senior research fellow at the University of Nottingham and one of the world's foremost experts on the Uyghurs.
This is a really large region that was created by the Chinese Qing Empire by stitching together this nomadic zone in the north with a really large desert surrounded by mountains in the south. And in that southern part of it, that's where the Uyghur people live, you have deserts that are watered by melting snow from the surrounding mountains that creates a ring of oases. Not the kind of oases you might imagine for, say, the Middle East, where you have date palms. These are places that are really enormous, hold sometimes multiple cities, and are marked by poplar trees and wheat fields and fruit orchards.
When was it incorporated into China?
For the most part, it's easiest to think of it as a place that came under Chinese control in 1760.
And who are the Uyghur?
Uyghur is the name of an ethnic group that has about 12 million people. They are speakers of a Turkic language, and almost all of them are Muslims. The vast majority are farmers, although there are also large cities in the region. Their culture is much more like that of Uzbeks or people in Afghanistan. And if you were to visit a Uyghur home, you would find it much more similar to life in, say, Iran than you would in Beijing. And it can be difficult for Uyghurs to pass as members of the majority based on physical features alone.
What kind of Islam do the Uyghurs profess?
The Uyghurs are nearly all Sunni Muslims, but they also have a lot of their own local practices. For example, putting yak tails on shrines or sacrificing a goose for a meal at the shrine and then stuffing its skin and leaving it as an offering.
Now, it's quite a long relationship that the Uyghur people, if they've been there those hundreds of years, must have with the Chinese. How has that relationship altered over time?
Well, for the first century of Chinese rule, the Chinese state was very hands-off and actually ruled the region through local intermediaries. It's really with the arrival of the People's Republic of China that we start to see some very strong interventions in Uyghur daily life. There's a long history of waves of more control and then opening up. And in the 1980s, there was a lot of opening where Uyghurs were able to rebuild a lot of the culture that had been destroyed in the 60s and 70s. And since that 1980s opening, things have just gotten tighter and tighter and tighter over time. More restrictions on movement, more restrictions on what you can say, more closures of holy places, restrictions on music, et cetera, banning of books. So, you know, there have been different reactions to this. Some looked for ways that they could integrate into the Chinese-dominated system. Others had a more pessimistic view where they saw increasing domination and thought that their, you know, culture was being slowly extinguished.
And if we go back a decade or so, there were incidents of violence, weren't there?
In 2009, a small number of Uyghurs working in a factory on the east coast of China were beaten to death by Han Chinese factory workers that worked alongside them based on an unfounded rumor. And this was caught on a really horrific video. And that video circulated widely and led to a peaceful protest in the capital of Xinjiang, Urumqi, asking for punishment of the factory workers who had beat the Uyghurs. And they were met with force by the police, and the city erupted in violence, which involved some Uyghurs killing random passersby, and then the next day, Han Chinese people killing random Uyghurs, and the People's Armed Police and other security organizations had to be sent in to put an end to this. And that was a turning point for the securitization of the region. It's after that that you get the entire region, every small town, flooded with men in camouflage and armored vehicles and checkpoints between cities.
And what happened after 2009?
Well, there was a rapid decline in the freedoms that Uyghurs had. It became even more difficult to leave Xinjiang and more difficult to leave China. Local governments started banning various names that were considered to be too Islamic, which you couldn't name your child. And then at the same time, you get a rise in violent protests of the sort that ranges from little local spontaneous attacks on officials to a handful of acts of terrorism targeted at civilians. And the most important one of those was the mass knife attack on train passengers in the city of Kunming in Yunnan. Now, this is outside of Xinjiang, and it really sent a shock through the Chinese public because suddenly the problem of Uyghur dissatisfaction with Chinese rule and the problem of violent protest was now one that could affect any Chinese citizen. And I think this is something that really contributed to Xi Jinping's desire to end all resistance to Chinese rule among the Uyghurs.
Ryan Thumb. That's the who, where, and when of the Uyghurs and their relationship with the Chinese government. Let's look at what's happening right now. Joining me in the briefing room are Joe Smith-Finley, Senior Lecturer in Chinese Studies at Newcastle University, and Josh Chin, the Deputy China Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. Joe Smith-Finley, you've been visiting Xinjiang since the mid-1990s. What did you find on your last visit?
I most recently was in Xinjiang in June, July 2018, and it was a very shocking visit. The atmosphere was extremely tense. There were convenience police stations, prefab police stations set up every 200 meters in the cities. And also I went to some rural areas outside Kashgar and it was the same there. These had audio surveillance facilities so they could listen in on conversations among people passing by up to 15 to 20 metres.
Joe, how could you tell that they were overhearing conversations as you went past these police stations?
Well, the two friends that I managed to meet up with, Uyghur friends that I've known for 20 plus years, warned me. So when we met up, we would be walking around continuously because they were too scared to sit down and talk to me anywhere in one place where we could be viewed and watched continuously. And every time we walked towards a convenience police station, they would warn me to stop talking about politics and to begin talking about something trivial. And then when we got another 20 metres past the police station, we would return back to the political topic again.
Josh, you've also made multiple trips to Xinjiang. Just how encompassing is this surveillance?
As Joe indicated, it is ubiquitous. It's all-encompassing and totally suffocating. Just basically, it's impossible to be outside, be in public, and not be in view of either surveillance cameras or police vehicles. So that's just kind of on the street. And then for Uyghurs living in cities in Xinjiang, besides the road checkpoints, there are ID checkpoints, you know, at the entrance to any public place. So a public square, banks, hotels, malls, markets, and, you know, apartment complexes, everyone has to scan your ID card, and there's a facial recognition camera that matches your face to your ID card. And that data sort of tracks where everyone is going at all times. So it's quite pervasive.
Now, there's a big fuss about Huawei here in Britain and the possibility of them being involved in our 5G system. Should we, on the basis of what you saw in Xinjiang, believe that companies like Huawei are involved in helping the business of surveillance there?
Almost all of the major Chinese surveillance companies that we've looked at have some sort of presence in Xinjiang. That includes Huawei, that includes big camera makers. They're very involved there. And there's also some U.S. technology companies who also sell technology into Xinjiang. So it's a, you know, it's a big market. There's a lot of money being spent there, and a lot of companies are profiting from it.
Joe Smith-Finley, are there techniques of surveillance and keeping tabs on people which are not reliant on technology, but which are more kind of person-to-person based?
The most obvious example of this is the visiting relatives program, which turned into a homestay program, whereby Chinese state officials will go into rural homes in South Xinjiang. Initially, from about 2015 onwards, this was just to visit and kind of inspect the family setup. From about 2016-17 onwards, this turned into a homestay program. So these officials would go into Uyghur homes and live with the families for between 9 and 14 days a month.
Live with them?
Live with them, yes. Live with them. And in many cases, these were families where the male head of the household had already been taken away and interned in a re-education camp. So in essence, you have a male agent of the state, Chinese agent of the state, who is not a Muslim, going into a Muslim household with the wife and the remaining daughters. And obviously, this throws up all kinds of questions. And these officials were given a manual on how to get Uyghur families to open up and how to get them to reveal their disloyalty to the state. So they would go into these homes and they would be looking for copies of the Quran. They would be looking for framed pictures of Islamic calligraphy on the walls. They would take Chinese dumplings into the house and offer them to the householders. The Uyghur householders will be thinking, do the dumplings have pork in them? If they have pork in them, I don't want to eat them. But any sort of hesitation at that moment would be interpreted as disloyalty and potential untrustworthiness. And this becomes a criteria for internment in a re-education camp.
Is it thought that these people who go to stay are also able to try and persuade Uyghur families to be less Uyghur?
Yes, absolutely. If you read Chinese media articles and also statements and reports posted on local government websites, these visits are often presented in terms of a kind of benevolent presence of the state. The state is helping these backward, often illiterate Uyghur families to become more civilized, to become more cultured.
Josh Chin, what we've revealed here is the gathering of enormous amounts of information about people. What happens to it?
Right. I mean, that's one of the sort of innovations, I think, if you use that term, in Xinjiang for the Communist Party and just in the way that they use technology for social control. And basically what that involves is a system that they refer to as the Integrated Joint Operations Platform. It was developed by a state-owned defense contractor that originally developed these systems for the military for sort of counterinsurgency operations. And they've installed this in a civilian capacity in Xinjiang, and it collects data. It collects all these information, these biographical details, whether or not they're willing to eat dumplings, whether they believe in Islam, how often they pray, where they pray, whether they have relatives abroad, all these sorts of factors. And then they use that to sort of calculate a rating of trustworthiness. And on the basis of that level of trustworthiness, they decide whether or not to send them to a re-education camp or to other sorts of classes or just to prison even.
So if you get classified as a result of this integrated joint operations platform assessment as unreliable, you could get sent to one of these now infamous camps. Now, Josh, what do we know about these camps?
There's an immense network of them. They're built across Xinjiang, and they kind of exist along this continuum. Some of them are quite small, converted vocational schools, and others are basically prisons. And one of the first ones that we'd found was outside of Kashgar in 2017. White walls, 20 feet high, topped with razor wire, guard towers. So immense, immense places. And the government said they were schools and they were vocational schools. But the police were putting in orders for thousands of police batons, handcuffs, cans of pepper spray, and cattle prods.
Not your usual college stuff.
Right, exactly.
We know that the population, the Uyghur population, is around 11 or 12 million. Do we know how many people have passed through these camps? And at what point do you get let out of them?
The Communist Party has never said how many people are in these camps. So there's no kind of official confirmation. There have been several estimates, one of them by a German researcher named Adrian Zenz. His current estimate is between 1 million and 1.5. It might be a little bit higher than that now, but certainly several hundred thousand. It kind of works out to one in out of every six sort of adult Uyghurs has been through these camps at some point. And they can stay anywhere from several months to more than a year. Others have gone in and not come out, according to their family members.
One imagines it depends upon the Chinese assessment of whether you're now safe to come out, does it? Or do we just not know?
As far as we can tell, that is part of the assessment, is how loyal do they think you are? How well have you taken on board the lessons? And you know, what we know from some people who have been let out, mostly ethnic Kazakhs who've been allowed to leave and then cross the border into Kazakhstan, you know, we know that a large part of what is going on is indoctrination. They spend most of the day in classes reading Communist Party documents, watching propaganda videos about Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, being encouraged to denounce Islam. The people who have been let out and been featured in state media as success stories are the people who have sort of taken those lessons on board, at least outwardly.
Joe Smith-Minley, is your understanding that these camps are permanent or just temporary, a phase in Chinese policy, which if it's successful, they can then be dismantled?
There's no way of knowing whether they were intended to be permanent originally. But we do know that some of the internment camps are now being very quietly closed down. But a very worrying trend is that as the authorities seek to transition out of the camp system, they are going in two other directions. And one is that some internees are being sentenced to lengthy formal prison sentences. And the other one is that some are being transferred as forced labour into factories in industrial parks. So to look at the first one of those, what we're hearing from former detainees who have managed to escape to Kazakhstan is that some people are deemed to have not been reformed, they haven't become loyal citizens, they haven't learned Chinese well enough, and they have then been sentenced via what has been described as an open court session within the internment camp itself. Now, younger religious men have been especially targeted for this new route.
Josh, I was just wondering, while we've been going through these things, how it is that we get this information in light of the fact that my understanding is that the Chinese government puts a blanket denial on all these accusations.
Party officials, you know, they're documenting what they do and they're documenting their work, and they write about it in state media and in other reports that you can dig up. Scholars like Joe, who still have contacts in Xinjiang, and then also relatives, you know, Uyghurs living in exile who are occasionally able to talk to their relatives and can relay information that way.
Joe Smith-Minley, as far as you can tell, what is the effect of all this upon the wider Uyghur population in Xinjiang?
The fear, the sense of absolute terror is immense. And I also spoke to Uyghurs in the community who were very, very worried about this imposition of what is now Chinese-only education from kindergarten onwards. And of course, if the parents have been doubly interned and the children are being taken away and put in the boarding schools, then they are now being raised in a purely Chinese linguistic and cultural system. Now, even where families have not been affected by internment, what we find is that those families are self-censoring. So unlike in the past, they will not be trying trying to orally transmit a Uyghur version of regional history, details of Uyghur religious culture, because obviously they're scared that if their children learn about religion, if their children learn about an alternative Uyghur nation or an alternative Uyghur national history, that this will put them in great danger politically later.
In addition to all the things that we've been talking about, there have been the beginning of revelations or suggestions that there are almost kind of eugenic measures that are being taken against the Uyghurs. What do we know about these?
What we're seeing in Xinjiang is a rate of 250 women per 100,000 being sterilised. And this is against a national average that has dipped right down to 30 women per 100,000. So we've seen a very, very steep rise in the graph showing this since 2016. And what we're seeing correspondingly is a recent report by Associated Press has shown the birth rates in Kashgar and Khotan to thoroughly religious Uyghur heartlands in the south absolutely plummeting.
Now, do we think that an explanation for this might be the demoralisation and lack of sense of future amongst Uyghur people? Or do we actually think that there is a Chinese government policy which is leading to this?
I personally believe that this is a deliberate policy which is targeting those particular regions. Now, those particular regions have long been seen as potentially the most problematic regions in terms of there being a very strong religious identity in those places. And if you read Chinese propaganda documents, I translated and wrote an essay on one last year, which talked about thought liberation in Xinjiang. They were talking about liberating and transforming the minds of the vast majority of Uyghur people, but they were also often mentioning a minority that were irredeemable, unreformable, how these people would be thrown into the grave of history. And this is a very chilling thing to read. And when you have coerced IUD coils and coerced abortion in these particular regions, then you need to begin to ask questions, particularly in a context where sterilizations across the rest of China have been gradually falling since 2010.
Joshin, let's talk about the Chinese calculation here. And I suppose the overarching question is, what do they think they gain by doing all this? What's the end state for them?
If you take them at their word, the way they've been portraying this is in terms of terrorism and as a counterterrorism strategy. And, you know, since 2002, after September 11th attacks, the party's really framed all of their problems in Xinjiang in terms of terrorism, and they equated Uyghur separatism with terrorism. And, you know, that is a line that the Chinese public largely accepts. I think if you zoom back a little bit, you can see that there are actually sort of several other motivations the party has here. You know, the first is that Xi Jinping's has a signature foreign policy initiative called One Belt, One Road, or the Belt and Road Initiative, which is basically an effort to sort of reboot the Silk Road for the 21st century. And the rail lines that China hopes to use to sort of connect itself to the rest of the world in this new infrastructure project, they all run through Xinjiang. And so just by necessity, you know, they really want to lock down the region and make sure it's secure and nothing's going to disrupt that. They've got a lot of money riding on it. You know, Uyghurs have always been, to a certain degree, second-class citizens in the rest of China. And a lot of Han Chinese see Uyghurs as being ungrateful for the economic development that the Communist Party has brought to Xinjiang. And they feel like this is a sort of civilizing mission, and therefore it's justified. And then, you know, Xi Jinping has really brought ideology back to the center of the party's identity. I mean, Xi has been really aggressive in going after ideological threats, Western liberal values, Christianity, and Islam as well. The Communist Party describes the influence of radical Islam in Xinjiang as an ideological virus. And the camps and the crackdown are all part of a public health campaign to eradicate this virus. And I think that they really do believe in some ways that this is an ideological threat to them.
Josh Chin there with Joe Smith Finley. There's no getting away from it, even on a programme as analytical as this one, it all sounds pretty grim. Now, as we know, the Chinese government is utterly resistant to anything it sees as interference in its internal affairs. So what can and what should other countries do or say about this situation? Charles Parton is a China expert and senior associate fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. What's the global response been so far to what China has been doing? Let's start with the United States.
There's a tendency to say that the United States is just trying to stop China's rise, and that's all that lies behind us. I think that's simplistic because, sure, there are members of the United States government who undoubtedly do have that motivation, but I think there are also very many members of the United States who feel very strongly about the lack of a level playing field in China, others that feel that the global spread of Chinese values and systems are actually likely to be deleterious to the way that most people like to live their lives. And there are those who actually, I think, find what's going on in Xinjiang and Tibet and Hong Kong to be absolutely abhorrent. You know, I don't think one can divide that up.
What about the United Kingdom?
You look at the debate that was held in Parliament on the 29th of June, and member after member from every party was absolutely strongly condemning the appalling things that were going on in Xinjiang. So we will find very few people who don't condemn this very strongly.
Does it translate into action, though?
If you hope that the United Kingdom or the United States or Europe or others can actually prevent what's going on, no. But there are things that we can do. I mean, I think that we should not be engaging with companies that are going ahead with some very active help towards the Chinese regime in the atrocities that are going on in Xinjiang. I just wanted to read out a quote to you. I have in front of me on my computer a photograph of a signing ceremony between Huawei and the Xinjiang Public Security Bureau. One of the directors of Huawei says, "Together with the Public Security Bureau, Huawei will unlock a new era of smart policing and help build a safer, smarter society." There are many companies that are piling in onto this surveillance experiment that's going on. I think that we should be doing a lot more in terms of publicity. We may well sanction people just as the United States have done under the Magnitsky Act. We need to go through the United Nations, as we already have done, but more often, of course, China simply blocks that. And I think the UK needs to be, as it's doing, I'm sure, urging the case with Muslim countries, because they, at the moment, are not really condemning what's happening to their co-religionists in Xinjiang. And ultimately, if these sorts of countries and others can be brought to bring measures against China, some of which will hurt them in the pocket, then there might be some effect.
Maybe they should, but is it your calculation that they are and that they will? In other words, the United States will take extra action, the United Kingdom will take extra action.
I think we do have to send a clear message that certain things are simply beyond the pale. Will that happen? Am I optimistic that that will happen? Perhaps not to the degree to which it should happen, but I think there's a momentum building up here. The major challenge for our countries is actually being united and working together. Once that starts happening, if that can happen, then China might have to start paying a little bit more attention.
Charles Parton, my thanks also to Ryan Thumb, Josh Chin and Joe Smith-Finley. And my conclusion, well, there's knowing and there's knowing. And now you know and you've heard what I've heard. So, one question. What would you want the outside world to say and do if you were part of the Uyghur minority? You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Beth Sagar-Fenton, Kirsteen Knight and Joe Kent. Mixed by James Beard. The editor is Jasper Corbett. If you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including The China of Xi Jinping, The State of the NHS After the Pandemic, and How Ungreen is Red Meat? You can find them all and much, much more on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.